You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver. Have taken from somebody else. And as we go
the Onondaga people wish to bring out about a healing between themselves and all others who live in this region that has been the homeland of the Onondaga Nation since the dawn of time. The nation and its people have a unique spiritual, cultural, and historic relationship with the land, which is embodied in the Guyana Shagawa, the great law of peace. This relationship goes far beyond federal and state legal concepts of ownership, possession, and other legal rights. The people are one with the land and consider themselves stewards of it. It is the duty of the nation's leaders to work for a healing of this land, to protect it, and to pass it on to future generations. The Onondaga Nation brings this action on behalf of its people in the hope that it may hasten the process of reconciliation and bring lasting justice, peace, and respect among all who inhabit this area.
Words from an historic land rights proceeding, now in federal court, filed by the Onondaga Nation in 2005. It was read by Andy Major, an activist with Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation in Syracuse, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The Onondaga Nation and Haudenosaunee Confederacy, to which it belongs, existed long before European settlers came to these shores. They had developed a sophisticated culture and governance style, which allowed them to live harmoniously with the earth and with each other. The culture of environmental stewardship practiced by the Haudenosaunee has been supplanted by a culture that views the land as real estate and resource base. The ultimate result of that way of thinking and acting is epitomized by the destruction of Onondaga Lake, site of the present city of Syracuse, New York, which has, in the course of less than 200 years, been turned into a toxic soup containing more than 22 million tons of industrial waste. The corporations responsible have mostly closed their plants and moved them to other countries, where they continue a similar process of destruction, which is called, in mainstream parlance, development. This weekend, Earth Day celebrations were held all over the country, and many of them focused on the need to address global warming, a result of the same type of industrial activity and thought processes that has laid waste to a beautiful lake in central New York. As millions of Americans are seeing and discussing Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth, as well as his recent congressional testimony about what should be done to respond to global warming, I would like to pose this question. Can these problems be solved using the same mindset, the same cultural values that created the problem? Gore has attempted in part to sell his solutions as a great economic opportunity. The condition of the earth must be restored, whether it benefits the economy or not. Seeing the land as profit opportunity or seeing the land as beloved home results in different behavior and priorities. Our culture devalues the land as home, relegating it to a natural resource, just as it denigrates people into a so-called human resource. Is it any wonder that our culture has transformed a paradise into a Prozac-popping, polluted hellhole of prisoners, wage slaves, and tin pot tyrants? I submit to you that the very reason that the powers that be have fought environmentalists with such ferocity is that they know that the preservation of Earth calls us to values different from those upon which their powers are based. The land rights action of the Onondaga Nation has called upon us to take up, with them, stewardship of the land. To that end, they came together with their settler neighbors in a year-long series of dialogues to discuss our common future. Many of these dialogues have already been broadcast on the show. Last October, a two-day event brought together Haudenosaunee leaders, scientists, lawyers, and Syracuse area residents to address the restoration of the land and water of the historic Onondaga Nation territory. We'll present a portion of that, beginning with a look at the land before the arrival of the Europeans and the land management practices of the Haudenosaunee, the ancient culture who called this land home for thousands of years.
In the way of the Haudenosaunee, all gatherings such as tonight's begin and end with the Thanksgiving address, when we are asked to put our minds together as one and notice that all the beings of creation, the plants and animals, winds and waters, sun, moon, and stars are each still carrying out their duties and making life possible for us. And for this, we are asked to give thanks. So now, welcome. There are three overarching themes for these 2 days. One is the Onondaga land rights and our common future. It gives us a chance to reflect on the opportunities presented by the Onondaga Nation as they assert their title to this area, their homeland, and as they ask us to join them in restoring health and vitality to the land and waters that bear their name. The second theme is reflections on the journey from environmental reciprocity to environmental exploitation and back again. And that's what we're starting with tonight. To tell the story of what happened, what this part of the world was like before Europeans invaded, who did such damage to this incredibly beautiful and bountiful part of the world, and how it was allowed to occur. And how do we heal and find our way forward to a new relationship among peoples and between us and the earth, one based on responsibility, thanksgiving, caregiving, and community? And there's a third theme, finding common ground, indigenous and Western approaches to healing our lands and waters, to ask and perhaps answer the question, how can traditional environmental knowledge, the information gathered through long-term productive relationship with a particular place and ecosystem, and passed on through story, ceremony, names, and ways of being, and scientific environmental knowledge, gathered through experimentation, observation, and analysis, and passed on through publication and replication. How can each be called upon for the common purpose of learning how to live well on the earth while living lightfully and thoughtfully in this land, our home? Little did we know when we started to plan these 2 days that events would conspire to make our project so timely. In the past few days, the New York DEC and Honeywell Corporation announced their plan for restoring Onondaga Lake. At first glance, the plan, at least as it has been described, appears to be the result almost entirely of Western scientific and engineering approaches focused on economic efficiency, and severe discounting of the long-term future. When faced with danger, build a wall, dig a trench. In this case, to stop the poisonous legacy of our industrial past from continuing to leach into the lake. To come to a consent agreement without the consent of the Onondaga leaders and their representatives is not how we have envisioned for finding common ground, succeeding in cleaning the lake and restoring the ecosystem. And yet it is still possible, indeed necessary, to go forward. We can all agree that the leaching needs to be stopped. DEC and Honeywell insist they will still want to hear alternatives. There is a way forward. It's called truth and reconciliation. First, Honeywell, the DEC, and all of us need to understand and explain honestly how and why the lake was so badly harmed. Then we need to apologize to the Onondaga people and to the lake and all its beings. And then we need to take full responsibility for making it right and ask the Onondaga leaders to help us determine in detail how to do that. Tomorrow night, same place, same time, we will explore several ideas for ways forward. Tonight, we look to our past and present. From its beginning, so-called Western science has developed from very different motivations, both love of nature and thirst for power. Some saw in new tools of science the opportunity of great power over others and great wealth for oneself. And there were also those who studied through painstaking observation and experimentation the workings of the world because they were fascinated by complexity and the mysterious interconnections of all things. Science was the branch of natural philosophy that searched for understanding of the profound intelligence alive in all things. Tonight, we have one of the latter form of scientist, a naturalist, a poet, a lover of science, a botany professor at SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, and a native woman of the Potawatomi people of the Great Lakes. So please welcome my friend and author of an eloquent book titled Gathering Moss, Professor Robin Kimmerer.
Bonjour, Nikan. Shabadaske gisko kwe nedeshnakas barwadami nagwa. Megichwian Bamadzuin. Hello, friends. Thank you for being here. My name is Robin Kimmerer from the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. As we gather here today, we're grateful for the good life that we share. Thank you, Jack, and thanks also to Noon, to SU, and to ESF for putting together this really remarkable and I think historic lecture series of the whole year. And to you, the public, for the tremendous support shown by your continued participation. I'm very much honored to be a part of it. And as I've listened through the past months of these series, it seems to me that something really important is happening here, a real groundswell, and it makes me hopeful that there will be a collective will to be very intentional about shaping our common future in this beautiful watershed. I also want to say that my own people, the Citizen Potawatomi, have been removed from their land not once, but in fact three times, removed from our ancestral homelands in the Great Lakes to end up in the dust bowls of Oklahoma. And they are fighting to revitalize traditional language and culture. And so I'm especially moved by the example of the Onondaga Nation and want to thank them, people who are still continuing to be on their ancestral homelands, never removed, and for their courage and strength in maintaining their culture, their stewardship for the same piece of land over generations, and especially for their current actions to protect the lands and waters of Onondaga. And tonight I was asked by the organizers to share some thoughts about the natural history of the Haudenosaunee homelands. And I'm delighted to do that. As a botanist and a plant ecologist by training and as a native person, I really view the plants as our teachers. It's part of our tradition, is that the plants are our oldest teachers. And so tonight, much of what we'll be talking about are some of the lessons of this place that are taught us by the plants. I'll share some slides with you all to kind of guide us through this. On the Onondaga Land Rights Action asks for healing and restoration of this place we live, of the land and the waters. And it seems to me that if we are to envision what restoration of this place would be like, it's useful to think about the ecosystem condition before the damage began. So we're going to go back in time, as far back as the land can tell the story. So back, not so that we can return to the past, but to use the past, the insights of the past, to give us some vision into the future choices that we make regarding healing this place. And if we look at the changes in the land, I don't need to tell anybody here about the kinds of changes that have occurred in our watershed. And tomorrow evening's program will focus more directly on what has happened there. But some of the things we'll be hearing about and talking about are changes in water quality, air quality, the soils, the species with whom we share this land, the management practices, food quality, all of the things that influence our material lives here, but also our human relationship to land. And despite all of these changes that have happened, this is still our home. And as we begin thinking about the choices that lie ahead in healing and restoration, I think it's useful just to reflect for a moment about the word ecology that comes from the Greek word oikos, that means home. So when we talk about ecology, we are literally doing the study of home. And then economics, which is often portrayed as in somehow opposition to ecology, is also about home. It's about the management of home. And I think a synthesis between these two ways of thinking, of course, is long overdue, and that's part of our vision for a common future. When we think about restoration and healing and imagining what our common future and our shared home now in this place might be, I think about abundance and how we might envision abundance in our community, and not the kind of material abundance that consumer society would try to sell us, but an abundance of human communities, an abundance of good neighbors, clean air and pure water, and an abundance of species with whom we share the planet, that kind of abundance. How do we get there? Tonight, I'm going to be talking about the outer circles that you see in this model here. I'm going to be talking from perhaps the perspective of a scientist about what we call the myth of the pristine, about what scholars know about the pre-settlement condition, the ecosystem conditions in the northeastern forests. And then later, Chief Jake Edwards and Jeannie Shenandoah will bring it much more close to home to talk about the Onondaga territories themselves. It would be presumptuous for me as a scientist to try to talk about someone else's homeland, so I'm delighted that Jake and Jeannie will be here to offer us those insights. Jack was talking about the different motivations that science has, and we know that when we think about ecological restoration, science tends to have a privileged voice, tends to work up in this corner of the slide here where we see mind. Scientific knowledge tends to be privileged over other ways of knowing. But an indigenous scholar by the name of Greg Cahete has written wonderfully that in traditional ways of thinking, we would never claim to understand something if we only understood it with our mind. We have to understand it with all elements of all of the human capacity of mind, body, spirit, and emotion. And I hope as we think about the natural history of the homelands here, we'll bring all of those human capacities to bear. Over the series, we've learned from many of the Onondaga Nation speakers about indigenous Haudenosaunee cosmologies. And what I want to think about now is what are the cosmologies or the creation stories that colonizing societies have? What is the creation story for a nation of immigrants? How do we understand our identity and our relationship to place? And I think you could say, fairly enough, that the creation myth of the American frontier has a number of important parts. First of all, part of that creation story is that the settlers, when they came here, encountered tremendous natural abundance in their mind. It was also unmanaged by indigenous people. It was a real wilderness, open to be transformed by the colonists, by the invaders. And Europeans believed that in the New World, from their own writings, they say, we encounter the virgin land, the forest primeval, a wilderness, untouched by human hands. But nothing could be farther from the truth. Some of the information that I want to share with you tonight comes from a wonderful book that I'd recommend to everyone, Bill Cronin's book called Changes in the Land, which is a cultural and natural history of the Northeast. And he has done some wonderful work in collecting these remembrances from the writings of colonists. This diagram gives us a quick look at a model for thinking about the interaction of people and their landscape. And what we see is that we can think about this some ecological trajectory of the communities. And then when native people came to North America, that ecosystem was altered. It was altered by the presence of indigenous people. And you see the upward line there. And then when Euro-Americans came here, the trajectory of the ecology of our place also changed again. And when we think about the impact of both Euro-Americans and native peoples on the land, it's important to remember that native people, while we say they lived lightly on the land, were in fact skilled, intentional managers of the environment. And when there's this language of the virgin land, But Francis Jennings has, I think, a really provocative phrase: if the land was less virgin than widowed, that when native people began to diminish under the hands of the settlers, the land became widowed, because in fact the native people had been so integral to the well-being of the ecosystem that without them, without their stewardship and care, the land was less than it had been. And so we're now going to think about what was our home place like? What was the state of land at the time of settlement? And restoration ecologists would call this the reference ecosystem. A reference ecosystem is that which we hope to restore to. And that clearly informs our visioning. Okay, there we go. So we'll look at that, what was the state of the pre-settlement ecosystem, first of all, through indigenous eyes. I think Jake and Jeannie may have more to say about that, as have many of our speakers through the series. But it seems to me that the Thanksgiving address is a very succinct way of thinking about what was the state of the ecosystem at the time of pre-settlement, where all of the beings and the forces in the ecosystem are named, their duties and responsibilities acknowledged. We'll focus on it through European eyes as well. So how do we know? When we try to say what was the state of the pre-settlement ecosystem, what was this land like 500 or more years ago? The sources of knowledge that scholars have used to try to answer that question come from traditional ecological knowledge of the indigenous people who lived here, from their oral traditions, and from the material cultures of people who inhabited this place. There's also scientific evidence associated with vegetation, things like pollen profiles, and witness trees. Witness trees are the trees that surveyors used when they were platting out the land. Instead of driving iron stakes into the ground, they'd say, the corner of this plot is this tree. And they would describe the tree in detail, its species, how big it was, etc. And so, therefore, we have some idea of what the landscape was like, simply from these very early survey records. Records of merchants, town, court, legislative records, journals, and letters of settlers all help to piece together the story of what was the ecosystem condition. When you look at that scholarly literature, what we see is that Europeans encountered large populations of indigenous people, and they describe them as being so beautiful and exceeding Europeans in stature and in physical beauty, and they were really remarkable in the nutritional standards, as the Europeans put it. They also encountered a land with high ecosystem integrity and resource abundance, far greater than what they knew in Europe. And if you just look at some of the interesting spellings as well of the journals of how people describe the landscape. The abundance of sea fish are almost beyond believing, had I not seen it with my own eyes. Our boats are bothered by thick schools of fish. Alewives arrived in such multitudes, pressing up such shallow waters as will scarce permit them to swim. The herring are stranded in knee-deep piles. Extraordinary abundance. You see here a list of some of the species that settlers encountered: Atlantic salmon, brook trout, eels, freshwater mussels by the basketful. Some of the early settlers also commented on the bird life. Waterfowl can be easily hunted, 100 geese in a week, 50 ducks at one shot. It may be counted impossible, but nothing is more certain. There are flocks of doves, by that they meant passenger pigeons, in the millions, without beginning nor ending, and so thick I could see no sun. One might think it was not true, but 'tis very true. A land of extraordinary abundance. The ecological food chains were intact. The high-level predators were still here. Wolves, wolverines, cougars, and fishers in central New York. Thriving wildlife populations, not only of familiar animals like the deer and the beaver, but bison, elk, and moose were also part of our landscape right here. They also turned their attention to the nature of the forests and talked a lot about how warm you could be if you lived here. Here is good living for those that love good fires. Though it be somewhat cold here in winter, yet we have plenty of fire to warm us, and a great deal cheaper than they sell in London. Nay, all Europe is not able to afford such great fires. their fire is here instead of our bedclothes. They indeed thought of this as an exceptionally rich place. So how does this inform our thinking about restoration and healing and understanding our place here in relationship to it? It's important to ask, why was this land so plentiful? And the answer will really come in two areas: the gifts of the land, the physical characteristics of these homelands, as well as the gifts of the people, cultural characteristics that also created abundance. Among the physical sources of abundance, we can name glaciers, soils, and seasonality. And those three factors combine to create this very plentiful landscape that settlers encountered. Just to touch briefly on a couple of these points, the glaciers that, living here, we kind of take for granted, glaciers having come and gone some time ago, but they left, of course, remarkable diversity in our landscape. There are places where the soil was deposited deeply and gives us these deep, fertile valleys. There are the organic soils up near Lake Ontario, the old Lake Iroquois. There are places where the glaciers scraped the soil away, leaving thin, dry soils, lakes, rivers. All of these things that we tend to take for granted as part of our landscape are, in fact, unique to this area. There are very few places on Earth that have this same combination of ecosystem and landform diversity. Mountains, lakes, rivers, and forests all packed together in the same place. The soils that we have here are also of remarkable fertility, in large part because of what we're experiencing right now, fall. When the leaves fall to the ground, seasonal litter fall, and the decomposition of those leaves makes for extraordinarily rich soils that you won't find in places with this, without our seasonality. There's lots of other attributes of our soils, but much of this has to do with seasonality and glaciers that make it quite unusual. Seasonality, our very sharp four seasons that we have here, also create abundance. Abundance for people who live here. And some of that comes from migration, these seasonal pulses in availability of wildfowl, waterfowl, for example. Fish, too, will migrate and spawn, and their seasonal patterns will change. And then wildlife species, of course, produce many, many offspring in order to deal with the harshness of winter. And so all of these things concerned with the harsh seasons that we have here yield abundance. The trees, too, in this part of the world are adapted to seasonality. Things like the beeches, the oaks, the hazelnuts, the hickories, etc., will sometimes produce tremendous quantities of food and sometimes not so much. But they tend to balance one another off. And so this became a land of plenty in terms of tree foods. The wetland plants, when we think about all the wetlands that once surrounded Onondaga Lake, that went up and down Onondaga Creek, those wetland plants are also adapted for the seasonality for winter, because this time of year they're storing carbohydrates like mad, putting lots of starches underground to fuel their own growth come springtime. But that also feeds people and waterfowl and wildlife. So what we see is that throughout the seasons, there was an abundance of resources that were provided by all of the other beings with whom human beings share this place. And you can just see in this brief diagram some of the abundance. And a diagram like this also gives us a sense of the richness of species, because when we're trying to think about how to restore ecosystems, we want to know, who are the players? What are the species that should be here? And their relationship with humankind, their generosity to humankind, tells us something about their role in the land that we might restore. But let's think of other sources of abundance. We said there are the sources of abundance that are the gifts of the physical land, but some of the abundance, in fact, much of the abundance that the settlers encountered here was not due to nature alone, but it was due to indigenous land management and stewardship. It was due to the caregiving practices of the Haudenosaunee people who lived here and other people throughout the region. So in fact, this American wilderness, it was a real myth, of course, that the settlers encountered a wilderness where there was, that had never been managed by people. In fact, indigenous people engaged in many what we call traditional resource management practices: burning, coppicing, which is a kind of pruning of wetland plants. They created a literal mosaic over the landscape with these ecotones. Ecotones are the edges between one patch of ecosystem and another. People also were involved in transplanting species from one end of a range to another. And so people were real agents of dispersal and agents of creating species diversity. Far from being passive bystanders, they were active participants in the diversity of their landscape. And all of these words here are only to say that if you're going to manage a landscape, if you're going to live according to a seasonal cycle, it requires extensive, detailed knowledge. It requires traditional ecological knowledge, or what I think of as native science. This list from meteorology to species interactions, successional patterns, this reads like the textbook or the table of contents of an ecology textbook. All of this was within the purview of native land managers. This knowledge, like science, was generated and maintained between generations for millennia. So let's now turn in specific to the plants, some of the most obvious aspects of our ecosystem here. And what was the nature of the pre-settlement vegetation? If you walked here 500 years ago, what would you see? Not the forest primeval. You'd see a place that was very patchy. Patchy in space, with a lot of edges between different kinds of vegetation, and patchy in time, because people were dynamic stewards of the landscape, changing it, managing it, and again, an abundance of these edges or ecotonal areas. One of the remarkable things about these ecotones is that they're very diverse. They not only have all the species that belong in, let's say, an old-growth forest, but they have the ones that belong on the edges and the ones that might be in the adjacent meadow. So these ecotonal areas created by people actually increased species diversity. This map brings it very close to home. This is the pre-settlement vegetation of Onondaga County. Maybe you can look and see what the forests look like around where you live. But if you look at this vegetation map, see that it's really quite different than what we experience today. First of all, there's that big swath in the middle of oak and chestnut. We're not going to find any chestnuts anymore. Only the southern part of the county was in these northern hardwoods, the beech, birch, maple, and hemlock, while much of the rest of the county was in oak hickory. And it's not that way today. The forest structure and composition that you might have found on a walk 500 years ago is very different from what you'd see today. And this photograph gives you a little bit of a sense of that. In an indigenous management landscape, the trees are larger, they're spaced far apart, so it almost looks like a park. And the kinds of species that we might have found that at that point were more oaks, hickories, chestnuts, walnuts, instead of the maples and birches. Not only did indigenous people manage for oak, hickory, walnut, and chestnut, because they were good food and good food for wildlife, for themselves as well as for wildlife. Again, if we turn to some of the journals that Bill Cronin cites in his work, they say the timber of the country grows straight and tall, some trees 30 feet high before they spread their first branches, forests so open they can be traversed by a large army. Interesting terms. In many places, diverse acres being so clear that one may ride a hunting. Why were the forests so different? In large part, indigenous management. Firewood harvesting changed the age structure of those forests. Intentional burning selected against those trees that can't tolerate fire, things like maples, while oaks flourish after fire, as do chestnuts and hickories. And some of the trees that really respond well to fire are not only resistant to ground fires, but then they'll sprout up from the base. And fire removes ground-level competition. So native peoples were using fire very skillfully to manage the landscape. Thomas Morton in 1640, the salvages are accustomed to set fire to the country in all places that they come and burn it twice a year in the spring and in the fall. And so that really produced a whole mosaic of resources by human activity. And again, the diversity of ecosystems that was produced was remarkable. In much of the literature, it tells us about all these berries that were produced in what were called berry barrens, again, a product of indigenous fire management. And berries would come up under the trees like this. One of the other reasons that fire was such an important traditional resource management tool was that it created meadows like this. Meadows like this that were very attractive to deer, to elk, and to bison. And so native people were managing a landscape in such a way that it benefited all of those species as well as themselves. to the point that some of the settlers, when they arrived here, they were really surprised that there weren't any domestic animals, that there weren't any barns. Why in the world would you need a barn if you burn a meadow and you create a big past, a patch of lush, succulent grass? Where are the deer and elk going to be? You don't need to lock them up in a barn. You create food for them and they'll be nearby. But this is not the way, of course, the settlers interpreted it. While intense seasonality can bring abundance, as we've seen, it can also bring winter hunger, another less positive consequence of the seasons. And so native people, of course, invented some of the most remarkable agricultural systems that the world has ever known. Fire, again, was used to clear for agriculture, and there were very large agricultural clearings created surrounding the villages. And just a word about Three Sisters agriculture, just a wonderful polyculture of corns, beans, and squash, as many of you know, where these three plants work together to support each other. Other crops, peaches, sunflowers, tobacco, were also grown here. Haudenosaunee agriculture supported large concentrations of people in very large villages, and this is what, of course, the settlers were responding to. And sadly enough, we know about some of the crops that were grown here by the records of the Sullivan campaign that documented just how many bushels of corn and acres of orchard they burned. And so what we see by these examples, by looking back into the cultural and natural history of the landscape, we really see that the land, the plants, the wildlife, the waterfowl provided all the material needs and the spiritual needs for maintaining life. So all of this abundance was created by caring for land. So a mosaic of landscape benefited people, plants, wildlife, water, and air. And what we see about all these relationships, where human beings are active participants as stewards of the ecosystem, not sitting by. The good of one is linked to the good of all of the others. What traditional resource management reminds us. If we look at our ecosystems today, just in terms of the biology of the system, there are a lot of missing pieces. Those doves that blacked out the sky that were the passenger pigeons are gone. Heath hens used to be here, they're gone. Wolves largely gone, lynx largely gone. The moose starting to make a comeback. But there are a lot of missing pieces from this mosaic of ecosystem diversity. We look at the trees, the American elm, which was so important in the culture of peoples here for longhouses and so forth, gone. The majestic chestnuts, gone. A lot of the traditional medicine plants, endangered. While many of our species were lost, others were added. Exotic species like purple loosestrife, garlic mustard, zebra mussels, lampreys, lots more of them. We've changed our neighbors. Let me turn now to thinking and finishing up here with different views of this landscape. Land is sustainer of life, might have been the way that the native people looked at it this way, as opposed to the folks who came here, viewed land as property, as a source of wealth and belonging. It's important to remember that George Washington was a surveyor. His early training was viewing land as property. And one of the reasons that I wanted to tell you the story of how people managed the land here was because the English preconceptions about lack of land management and their grasp of this myth of the pristine was one of the reasons that they justified dispossession of native people. They said the Indians are not able to make use of 1/4 part of the land. Neither have they settled places as towns to dwell in. They change habitation from place to place. The Puritan culture that came here took exception to the way that native people lived because in the English mind, hunting, fishing, picking berries were pastimes of the idle rich, not ways of sustaining oneself and sustaining the land. But because native people worked with natural processes, the land didn't seem to be substantially altered from a state of nature to the Europeans. They really did view this as a wilderness, not as a carefully tended and stewarded landscape. And so in the writings of many of the English, what we see is that we should come and take this land. This land is open to us because Native people were not improving the land. They had no domestic animals. They had these gardens that weren't planted in straight rows with only one kind of species. They had impermanent dwellings. They didn't own property. Therefore, in the mind of the conquerors, the land was free for the taking. Jonathan Winthrop gives us another reason why they thought this land of abundance was free for the taking. Epidemics were a sign of God's providence in sweeping away great multitudes of the natives so that he might make room for us here. Forces us to think, what does land mean? If I think about some of the traditional teachings of the Potawatomi people, of indigenous people all over the world, we view land, the home places, not just as our residence, but as the place of all of our relatives, the non-human persons with whom we share this place. Land is our connection to ancestors. Land is a healer. Land is home, as sustainer. We often identify ourselves by where we came from. Land is part of our identity. Land is a holder of wisdom. It's a source of knowledge. Land is our moral responsibility. And to these indigenous concepts of land, we add the new ideas. Land as capital and land as property. So how do we view the land and the relationships that we want to make in this place as we heal and restore? Should land be a source of belongings, or should land be a source of belonging? When the Onondaga Land Rights Action speaks of restoration and healing, what all this involved? Yes, healing the ecosystem, trying to return it to some aspects of the reference ecosystem which we've just painted. But oftentimes, it seems to me that it's not the land that's broken. It's our relationship to it. It's a broken relationship that got us to the place that we are today. And so the theme that I've tried to develop here is to understand where abundance comes from as we try to envision it for ourselves. And I think some of the lessons of traditional knowledge are that abundance flows when we've met our responsibilities to land, when we are, again, active participants and stewards in the landscape. So what we're looking for in thinking about the healing of the land and understanding what it looked like 500 years ago is not a return to the past, but, as Jack said, a way of going forward. And most of us here are immigrants to this place. Maybe our families have been here for many generations, but fundamentally we're all immigrants here. And one of the challenges of an immigrant society, if we are to live sustainably, is to do what I think of as becoming native to place, living as if this was the land that sustained you, living as if land was a moral responsibility, as if it were our home, as if it sustained us. And I think I'll close there, and now we'll narrow that circle from thinking in a sort of a scientific sense about the broader context of the homelands and the natural and cultural history to now thinking about them in specific in the Onondaga territories. Thank you.
Robin will join us again at the end. So now we're going to have a bit of a discussion with Jeannie Shenandoah, who is a teacher, an herbalist, a healer, a midwife, and someone who's been very active in bringing to us both her own personal perspective on the land and waters here, and also the voice of the Onondaga Nation. And Joyce King, who did not expect to be doing this, but is happy to join us. Joyce is a Mohawk woman who is also the director of the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force. And welcome to Jeannie and Joyce. Yeah.
Yeah. First of all, I want to thank Joyce for filling in here. I wasn't planning on sitting here alone. I guess we're asked to have a conversation about our relationship to the land and the water around us. And so I guess the first comment I thought about making was the fact that our people were living here in this whole area. This is our Aboriginal area, this pretty good-sized swath of land. And when the immigrants, to use Robin's word, first came here, they thought they were discovering an mostly uninhabited, unused piece of property here, and proceeded to move right in. And didn't realize that a lot of these places here, although they might appear to not have been used or developed, they certainly were very, very much used, but in a different way by our people. Many of these places, when they came here, had names. They already had names for different places around here, and they still have names. Because they don't appear to be commercialized or clear cut or whatever, doesn't mean that they weren't used. Many of these areas have very sacred, special meanings to us. Right now, through Onondaga Nation runs Onondaga Creek, which somebody named it after us, I guess. We already have a name for it. I made myself a few notes here. What we call it is Utnikahtandyu, which means running water. The water is constantly running. And that water means a lot to us, we who live there at Onondaga Nation, and I'm sure it means a lot to the other people that live along Onondaga Creek, right from the headwaters in what is now named Tully. I'm sure it already had a name before that, too. You know, everything here did. These days, everything has the name of Onondaga on it. Onondaga. Lake, Onondaga Hill, Onondaga County. It's sometimes a little bit difficult to accept the fact that our people are... Now, I was recognized for having always been here when every other thing around here is named for us. Probably some kind of containers or something, too, you know, anything.
It's not as bad as the Mohawk, you know. You have the Niagara Mohawk and, you know, Mohawk pulp and paper.
Yeah. Yeah, just about everything, you know. Well, anyways... These people came along to this body of water that's now named Onondaga Lake. It was already there before they got there, and there were already people there before they got there. Our people, the people that came before us, the grandmothers and grandfathers, the families and the clan families of the people, Onondaga people, which, by the way, isn't even... Onondaga, it was kind of anglicized by people that came round. The actual pronunciation is Onondaga. That's the way that we pronounce what we call ourselves. And that was changed, and then they named the lake after us and proceeded to use it. That lake has many names, as do many places in this area. That lake has a very sacred, significant, spiritual meaning to us. Our people lived around this area. Because you didn't see a household dwelling there didn't mean that we didn't live there. Because our people moved around the area, traveled around for many days for certain things. There were certain areas around the lake that had names. For instance, maybe it was a place where we went to gather medicine, or maybe there was another area that specific roots were plentiful there, things that we used for ourselves. There are places of around the lake where one place was called Jyotiketa, which means it's where the salt is. So I imagine it's where the salt springs were that the people knew about. Of course, to this day, it's a little bit difficult to use all those names because the lake has been changed so drastically. Changed because somebody came along and decided that they found themselves a good resource here, and so they were going to just fix it all up for the way that they wanted it to be. So it's not even the same size it was. The water level has been changed. The mouth of the creek has been moved out 3 times or something like this. You know, it's all been manipulated and disrespected for what it was and used for somebody's benefit. These places had names because our people used them to fish. There are certain areas, people that do fishing know that fish, different types of fish, like to live in different currents or depths or temperatures of water. So some of these places had names of where they would go and catch specific fish. Right now, I would just tell everybody, don't ever catch a single fish in there. It's dangerous to your health. So one of the main names that we called that lake was Gahnekasaya, and that meant that it's one of the places that our people always used, and we considered it that we lived there because we were around there. We were all around, moving around. Maybe not so much as maybe spent a couple days in certain spots. I know like this time of the year is a good time for people that harvest certain roots and things to go. And myself and some of my friends will travel to a certain spot and maybe stay there for 2 or 3 days while we're having a nice, peaceful time harvesting whatever we have to do before the winter comes along. So our people have always had this connection to this whole area, a very spiritual connection. As a matter of fact, as a lot of you know, the peacemaker came to this territory. And there's a lot of story that goes along the lake when he came along traveling. It takes many days for one of our people to recite this orally, to remind our people of the story when he came along towards this community here. He came to a place where the three rivers meet, and he stopped there and spent some time thinking and dreaming because he recognized that this was such a sacred spiritual place that he could actually feel it. So he thought a long time, he thought long and hard which way he would go. And then he decided, he went in his canoe and he came to the lake and he stopped. And again, he took a lot of long time thinking and dreaming and thinking about the sacredness of this area and which way he would go, which way he would travel. So he traveled very slowly. He went all around the lake. He knew this was a very, very special, powerful, sacred place, bringing the great word of peace to our people. And he also knew, had heard of this creature that lived in this area that many people were very fearful of. I guess in these days we would call him a demon or a devil, something very dark and evil. So the story goes that he traveled around this lake on this mission that was sent to us. Our people were in a very bad condition at the time. And this man was given the mission to come and bring this great peace, to bring us these teachings, to help us to be good people. So he came upon this person. He carried this great word. It's very hard to tell you about it, to describe the preciousness of this message of peace, and how sacred this area is. That message of peace was so powerful that it organized our people. organize all the Haudenosaunee people all across this area. We became what you know of as the Six Nations Confederacy. We call ourselves. We have our own name before somebody else named us. We already were Haudenosaunee. That message of peace that came to this very spiritual, sacred place is such a great message that now people are hearing it all over the world. People are coming to hear it. We've always had people that have heard of it and are coming to our place here, the heart of our Confederacy, coming to hear the great words, because we were taught to for the white roots of the Tree of Peace would go in the four directions and enable everybody to learn peace. Now, those are the some of the feelings that I have towards this area, to let you know how sacred and how connected we are to this. Those teachings to this day are still with us. They have not ever stopped. We still have many names for places around here. The whole area from the Tully Lake area, Onondaga Creek comes through to Onondaga Lake. That has very great spiritual significance to us also. The other day, we were at up there at Willow Bay when the EPA was signing their agreement. And somebody asked me, where was the Tree of Peace planted? I said, you mean like where? You mean like right here kind of? Yeah, well, where was it planted? And I said, I don't have to tell you where it was planted. I don't even have to say whether I know or not exactly the spot. Because if I said it was planted right here, about 3 feet over here, then what would happen is then you would go tell somebody. And then that somebody would say, like, oh, we found out where the Tree of Peace is planted. So let's all go over there, all of us. And then more people would keep coming and coming and coming. And so this whole sacredness would kind of be trampled on. It would be trampled over, because all these people would be all running over there to get a piece of it. Instead of us all sharing a love for this whole area and holding it close to our hearts. And that's how things are spiritual and sacred. You hold it close to your heart and you acknowledge it. You acknowledge and respect, so that things do not become commonplace. So I guess that's just kind of what I wanted to tell you about our connection to the earth and our connection to this area here. I always tell everybody that that I live right here. I've looked all around different parts of the world, and I'm right here where I truly love where I live. And I hope everybody else does. Everybody has that right to love where you live, acknowledge it, and respect it. We're all living here together. That's the reality right now. We all live here together. That's the basic message, I guess, I have.
One of the things that happened when this world was formed and the Creator sent us messages, he said that I have created everything for you, for mankind to live here. And your responsibility is to give thanks. There are certain times within our history that we forget to give thanks. And when that happens, there's turmoil in the world. It happened when the peacemaker came here. We forgot our lessons. We forgot how to give thanks. We forgot, you know, the names of places. And he came and he said, you know, he brought us back together under this great law of peace. And one of the things that one of the lessons he brought to us was to talk about, we all have one dish, one spoon to share. And when you look at that, when you look at one dish, one spoon, you're looking at an environmental philosophy. And that environmental philosophy says that we share in the resources. And one of the things you do is you first give thanks. You have to give thanks for everything that was provided to you.